Okay, so let me do this real quick. Okay, this is apologetics session 3, and we're covering how does one use apologetics. So we're at develop the number 3, develop the inner life of the soul and mind for character formation. So actually, you could just go through this, babe. Yeah, and then the next slide. And then the next slide. Yeah, I keep going a little bit further. We're skipping a few things, but that's okay. We got a little late start. Develop the inner life of the soul and mind for character formation. So this is emphasizing the important things of life, keeping the first things first things, and second things second things. And basically, we need to remember that becoming like Christ and serving Him are both essential in the Christian life. We cannot just be pure servants and then lose our relationship with the Lord. We have to develop the sanctification of the soul. And this is done through the daily devotions, the spiritual disciplines that we all know about and probably do often. I'm just telling you this now because as a guy who's been in the apologetics field for a while, ministry, it's easy to just learn this stuff over here and kind of let the Bible, you know, go unnoticed. And we need to be careful of that. So we must continually desire sanctification, becoming like Christ, to know that we are not whole until we reach heaven. And our brokenness and our dependence on Jesus is a daily task for the apologist. It's who we are, and who we are will come out on the street real quick. Our character will come out in these conversations because we will get angry sometimes with what people are saying. And so we have to keep in mind who we're representing, who we're ambassadors of, and what is His nature, and reflect that as if He were us, just like an ambassador would and represent the United States, in the same way we are ambassadors to another nation of people, if you will. Along with that note, is that we need to recognize where people are at when we talk to them. People are going through a lot often, and including ourselves. And so spiritually, emotionally, we need to love them and respect them where they're at. So maybe they said something to you last week that got you going, and you spend a whole week studying and preparing, and now you got a chance to respond, say at work or something, and they're just like, they lost their puppy that morning. You know, they don't want to hear it. And so we just got to be reflective and you know, empathetic with them and what they need at that time. We need to care for their soul while treating the issues of their mind. And I'm saying this now because, again, it's easy for someone to become an analytical person and then just stop understanding, you know, that the other person is a person. You know, we just get excited about winning an argument. This can happen. So I'm telling you now as a disclaimer to be careful of that. People will hear our tone more than we do. And our tone really is what they hear first. In fact, tonight you're hearing my tone probably, at least this first part of the class, more than what I'm saying. Is Jeremy boring tonight? Is he having a hard day? You're hearing this texture in my voice. And so they will hear that in yours as well. And when they hear us, let them hear the tone of grace and truth. We talked about John 1:17, where Jesus came to bring grace and truth, both at the same time, confronting the unbelief issues with truth and loving the person with grace. Okay, so we need to just keep this in mind, and I'm telling you this in advance, just being down this road a little bit. Stand up for what one believes in the public square. So the public square, this concept, has anybody done any sociology or history in their time and understand where this public square idea comes from?
Is that just like where people stand on the soapbox and preach out in the public square?
Yeah, so that's a similar idea, right? So if we take that back a little further and just think about how civilizations developed and how people groups settled into areas, we see that there's public buildings, temples, churches, shops, and so forth in a city center. and it's usually a square. When I went to Chile a couple years ago, we were in these very old areas of Chile, kind of where it was colonized by the Spanish, and we had gone into all these little cities, and there was a square in the middle of each one, and they all looked exactly the same. And the square was probably about a football field wide and long, and on one side there's church, public building, a bunch of stores, and you could tell that how the city just developed from that. And originally these public squares were designed for marketplaces, so people would bring their goods and trade them, produce, vegetables, all this stuff. And the public square became a place where transactions were made, ideas were exchanged as well. So it's a place where goods are moved around and back and forth, but also that ideas were propagated. And so the same is true today. We have our own public squares, but they look different. A lot of our public square has moved online. Ideas are going crazy online. They're transferred all over the place all the time. And so we have to do our apologetics in this public square. The public square may mean, for you, your office or your commute, you know, if you're carpooling with someone. It could be anywhere in our day. But the public square term, when you hear that in philosophy or apologetics, that's where it comes from. It comes from this kind of ancient time. And, you know, it's been around since the Greeks and everything. And so we need to provide rational and compelling reasons why other worldviews are flawed and do not best represent reality in the public square. So this is either one-on-one or in front of multiple people. The Holy Spirit will give us the boldness, will give us the strength when we don't think we have it, and we'll be able to sometimes remember things that we've thought we've forgotten. And it's really amazing how that has happened. To me especially, I've been in situations where my mind has just been so blank, and I haven't been thinking about apologetic stuff for maybe 2 months or something, and all of a sudden the Holy Spirit brings back things to mind as I'm talking with the person. And so don't let idleness take you out of the game. Just remember that the Holy Spirit will help you recall these things if you've ever been off of, you know, your apologetics journey for a little while. So apologetics is not something done in the closet. It's both. We use it on the street, in the public square, but we also study it. It's a both. It's not an and. It's not an either or. Item 5 there. Find evidence or reason that can be used to argue a compelling or inductive case for some aspect of apologetics so as to provide clear direction to truth. And the first week we talked a lot about what apologetics is and why one should do in apologetics and study apologetics. I don't want to repeat all that information, but we just want to recall that apologetics is proof and persuasion. It's a combined approach. We want to persuade people and not just, you know, give them a bunch of information. We want them to find Christianity compelling, because the love of Christ compels us. And so we then ought to show people how they can enjoy the love of Christ, help them reduce down their walls and see Jesus face to face. And that's the task of apologetics. I think I was saying this to someone the other night, that when you're in front of Jesus face to face, he's extremely compelling person. And Calvin says he's irresistible, and his grace is irresistible. So that's what we want to do. We want to try to get people to Jesus himself so they can see him face to face and make a decision. And this is sometimes called pre-evangelism. So apologetics kind of sometimes will fit in that category, where we kind of sow the seeds and lay the groundwork so that later on maybe someone could reap the harvest of our labor, but it doesn't really matter. It's all going to the Lord. But sometimes apologists are pre-evangelists, so we kind of prepare the soil for someone else to come along later. So if you're there, you can see we're at know the burden of persuasion. The burden of persuasion, by the way, we usually take a break around 7:45. 8, and we'll take a 10-minute break at that time too. And what I'd like you to do on this part, if you can just give me grace and erase or cross out with your pen item 2, P times G equals B, and all of item 3, all of what that says there. I reread that this week and found that it was a little confusing, so just put a big X in through it, and we're not going to talk about that. But I want to walk through this with you a little differently. This is the burden of persuasion. This is the level of proof required for one to justify his claim. So if I make a claim, what level of certainty do I need to prove to in order to be justified? Now, this is not how much evidence do I need to show, like what type of volume or pile of evidence do I need to present to somebody. This is what level of certainty do I need to convince myself to or you to. So it's the level of certainty. If you think of certainty as a thermometer from, say, 0 to 100, and the red goes up and down, that, think of that as your certainty meter, and we all have one. So when we're listening to arguments or presentations, sermons on Sunday morning, we all will have different levels of certainty as the presentation goes forward or when we leave, things like that. So our certainty meter goes up and down depending on what's happening and who we're listening to, who's trying to convince us of what. So what is the level of proof required to justify a historical claim? So if I make the claim Jesus rose from the grave, or the Bible reports facts of history, or people were miraculously healed in Jesus' time, those are historical claims. Jesus rose from the grave. It's a claim about history. What level of proof is required to justify that claim? What level of certainty does one need to have in order to say, yeah, I have knowledge, or yeah, I can believe this and be justified? We're going to answer that in a second, but consider this. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendments to the Federal Constitution prohibit criminal defendants from being convicted on any level of evidence, okay, any level of certainty, less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So what that means is that basically they're saying if you're in a criminal court and you're being tried for murder, the jury or judge has to be convinced to a certainty level called beyond reasonable doubt. This is a high level of certainty, and it's high because the Supreme Court is protecting innocent until proven guilty and protecting criminals from being misjudged and thrown into prison for something they didn't do. So they're saying for the jury, you have to be super certain or very certain that this person is guilty. So Casey Anthony last year, the jury found her not guilty. Why? Not that the evidence wasn't good or there wasn't a lot of it. It's just because their certainty meter wasn't high enough. Does that make sense? So in criminal law, the burden of persuasion is fixed on the prosecution. They're the ones that are arguing for the guilt of the defendant. And this doesn't change during the entire trial. They have to show the proof. And so the certainty list that we see here in our notes, we're going to look at that right now, and it's going to help us understand different levels of certainty that we need to come to in order to justify a claim. So if I'm 0 to 10% certain in criminal law, I have complete skepticism, okay? I'm 0 to 10% certain that somebody is guilty. Let's say Jesse is guilty of stealing bacon, okay? But I need to prove this to you, okay? You're the jury. And so you're 0 to 10% certain that Jesse stole bacon. You're completely skeptical. And this means basically you're absolutely unable to believe. So if you're 10 to 25% certain, this is called reasonable suspicion. The cops can frisk you if they have this, or if the DA has this. If they're, let's say DA or the police is 25 to 50% certain, they have what's called probable cause and can issue a warrant for your arrest, or for Jesse's arrest. Because we don't like people who steal our bacon. And if you're 50, if they're 50.1 to 75% certain, this is known as preponderance of the evidence, okay? And this basically means, preponderance means the majority or more probable than not. So for civil cases, not criminal, for civil cases, all we have to do is convince the jury that it's more probable than not that so-and-so is guilty, okay, in a civil case. But back to criminal cases, if the judge or jury is 75 to 90% certain, this is called clear and convincing evidence, and in special legal circumstances, this is the level that you have to reach as a jury. You have to be convinced to high probability that it's highly probable that Jesse stole the bacon. If you're at the 90% to 99.9% level, you're at the beyond reasonable doubt level. This is enough in criminal law, based on the criminal law standard, to convict someone. And I realize that your notes have a little bit of a messiness happening here. So all the letters, D, E, F, G, should kind of be lined up, and the items that are below the letters should kind of be indented over. So if you could just kind of picture that in your notes. Sorry about that. Something happened there. So that's the level that's required to convince a jury or judge that you're guilty of Jesse's guilty of stealing the bacon. And of course, if you're at 100%, then you're absolutely certain, and it can't be denied. But no one's really ever there. Okay. So in a civil law case, the civil law again, not criminal law, the prosecution and defense has a burden of persuasion. They both have to convince, whereas in criminal law, it's just the government has to convince, just the DA's office has to convince. So they both must present their thesis to have people be convinced to the more probable than not 50.1% level. Now, let's hash this out. How does this relate to us? If beyond reasonable doubt is the required level for showing the existence of God, or that Jesus rose from the grave, or that man needs a savior to be saved, something like that, this puts me in a position to argue for a lot of facts to a high level of persuasion. Okay? I would have to get a lot of stuff together, use all of my apologetics, and convince people until they're beyond reasonable doubt. That's not required for history. It is required for criminal law, but it's not required for the field, the practice of history, which is good news for us. History is different than criminal law and more like civil law. All we have to do with historical claims that we make as apologists or pre-evangelists, whatever, is just reach the level of certainty that's 50.1%. So it's more like civil law. Because if you think about it, in history, let's consider this scenario. The question, did Homer's Iliad report a real Trojan War, or was it reporting fiction? Some thinkers say it's reporting fiction. Some thinkers say it's reporting fact. So if we have enough historical and archaeological evidence to show that it is more probable than not, then he did have an actual war. We can be certain in saying, we can have a certain level of certainty, if you will, that he did have an actual war, or that Troy was actually attacked. For historians, this is all you need. You don't need to be convinced to beyond reasonable doubt. And that's great news, because if we had to be convinced to beyond reasonable doubt level, it would be the case that we didn't know a lot of history. I'll hash that out for you when I find my notes here. The skeptic, he tries to create, when he's talking to us, a false standard of history and tries to get us to, tries to make it so that we have to persuade to a level of beyond reasonable doubt. But that standard is not lived up to in any other part of the field of history. No historical scholar will need to be convinced to a beyond reasonable doubt level. They put it on us saying that extraordinary evidence is necessary for extraordinary claims. You may have heard that. In fact, Hume was the one that propagated this idea. We learned a little bit about Hume last week. So extraordinary evidence, though, is not required to make extraordinary claims. Jesus rose from the grave. They say, that's an extraordinary claim. You need to show me extraordinary evidence. But that's a presupposition, and they can't argue for why they hold that view. That's a presupposition that they're putting on us as, say, fellow layman historians, and we don't have to live up to that standard because no other scholar in the field of history does have to live up to that. Any questions so far? Yes.
These Scopel's books.
Yeah.
Would you categorize them as beyond reasonable doubt?
No. But let me speak to that. The good thing about Christianity, the great thing about Christianity, is that it's based in history. Whereas some other religious worldviews, say Confucianism, or maybe even Buddhism, is not based in history. Buddha, the original Siddhartha, he was an actual figure, sure, but what happened with his life and the places he went to, and there's nirvana state, that cannot be empirically justified. It's a subjective experience. Whereas Christianity, you have Jesus Christ as a physical, real person doing a bunch of stuff that can be empirically verified by eyewitnesses. And so what's great about Christianity is that not only is it based in history, and we have history to speak to us, literature, archaeology, and so forth, that historians also use with other historical discoveries, but that all this data and all this evidence we have actually does convince someone to a beyond reasonable doubt level when you actually look at it and experience it. So the cool thing is that all we need is to be 50.1% certain that these things actually took place. But in reality, we really have a 90% level of certainty once you start getting into the material.
I don't quite understand what you just said. Sounds
okay.
Like,
yeah.
The bottom line is, isn't there enough proof out there of the existence of Christ such that, okay, so Christ did live. Is the issue then, was Christ God? Or what was the issue?
Yeah. Yeah, so whether he was God, whether he was raised from the dead, whether he did miracles, whether he existed, some people would even deny that. We're going to learn next week how to show that Jesus actually existed, or 2 weeks from now. But yeah, so people would say Jesus didn't live, he didn't rise from the grave, he wasn't killed on a cross. All these things, and all we need to do is show to a level of 50.1% that it's more probable than not that he did do them rather than he didn't. And so it's more probable than not that Troy was attacked than it wasn't. There's enough evidence to show that one could be persuaded to say, yes, Troy was attacked. It's more likely that it was attacked than it wasn't. It's more probable than not. It's more likely than it isn't. Napoleon conquered all these places in Europe. That's more likely to have occurred in history because we have literature, we have archaeological findings, and so forth. So we know that it's more probable than not that Napoleon did attack and conquer these places than he didn't. Does that help? Yeah.
Just laid out all this stuff in a day or two. Uh-huh. And yet there's Jesus.
That's a great question. So it depends on what their presuppositions are, whether they're willing to believe and listen. But in my opinion, a reasonable person ought to conclude, unless he's being irrational, that Jesus was God, Jesus did rise from the grave. Because to me, the evidence is compelling. It's compellingly clear. I'm 90% certain. So my certainty meter, just to let you know, for all things, historical philosophy and everything related to Christianity, usually fluctuates between like 85 to 98% on any given day. So I just tell people I'm 92% certain that the truth claims of Christianity are based in history, logic, science, so forth. And that's beyond reasonable doubt level. I mean, that's big time. And I conclude, and I would compel you to do the same as we go through this, to be open-minded and see this material as we study it in the next several months and say, is this stuff really true? Let me look at it through a skeptic or non-Christian's perspective instead of a Christian's. I asked God that when I was in college. God, let me see things through the eyes of an unbeliever. And he did that. Unfortunately, it actually happened. And since then, I've been wrestling through concepts for 10 years now, and but always being convinced, or most of the time, 90% of the time, being convinced that, it's this stuff is true. This stuff actually happened. It corresponds with reality, and I'm at the beyond reasonable doubt level. And if you say I'm 100% certain, Jeremy, I don't need any of this apologetics, I don't need anything. Well, fine, that's great, good for you. You're 100% certain. I'm not going to try to knock your certainty meter down. I'm just telling you that there's going to be a point in time, and don't be afraid of this, and don't be surprised when something comes up and you have no clue how to respond to it, and it actually is bugging you. And it's like, gosh, well, if that's not true, then maybe Jesus isn't God, and maybe God doesn't exist, and all this is a lie. You know, you may start going down that path quickly. So just don't be surprised that if you're on your high horse and platform that something's not going to come up that's going to freak you out in the future. Kristen, yeah, so we got a lot of participation now all of a sudden. This is great. Okay. Go ahead, Sarah. That's a good point. It would definitely be a pebble in their shoe, if nothing else. Yeah, but if they're really open-minded or really soft in terms of their understanding capability, in my point of view, they ought to be 90% certain. Yeah, Kristen.
When you're talking about history and what's required for history, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are you going to talk about how you deal with that at all?
Yeah, so science is the only way we can know reality. That's their claim, right? Science is the only thing that gives us knowledge of anything. Okay, so, but listen to that statement again. Science is the only way to know anything. That's a self-refuting statement, isn't it? How does someone come to the conclusion through science that science is the only way to know anything? It's a philosophical statement, isn't it? You're speaking philosophy when you say that. So by doing science experiments, one can do that his whole life, and he'll never arrive at the position, science is the only way to know things about reality, because no science experiment ever told him that. It's a philosophical presupposition in the mind that comes up. And that's a self-refuting statement. So it's called a suicidal proposition. And we're going to talk about suicidal propositions actually later today, and that is one of them, actually. And it's here. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. He didn't exist?
Right.
Yeah.
He's, you know, fictional.
Yeah.
So for them, they need to be 100% sure that there is a Christ.
Yeah. Now, isn't that...
How does that...
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're going to learn in the second half. Yeah. And then next week, we're going to learn how to present that Jesus was an actual person. But the standard that they're putting on religious statements is something that they can't even live up to themselves. It's a standard that if they held all of history like that, they wouldn't be able to know anything. Because how are they going to look back and say Napoleon actually did these things? They weren't there. They didn't see Napoleon. All we have is literature and archaeology, right? Just like all we have for the New Testament. And so you have to basically be, you have to say, I can't know anything that any elementary school teacher, high school teacher taught me. Yeah, it's very much like Hume with his adamant skepticism. Yeah, and that's what they're saying. But they're doing that arbitrarily, and it's not fair. They need to think about all of the history that they're then denying if they hold to that.
Too high of a standard?
Too high of a standard, yeah. Yeah, and one more thing about the Kristen's question. Kristen, I would just also ask them to say, well, do you believe in numbers? Do you think that numbers are real? If you're a science person, do you think that... love is real? Love is not something that can be measured with science. I can't do a science experiment on love, nor can I on numbers. Colors. I can't do a science experiment on colors. I can kind of see colors and look at colors and do all this optical lens stuff, but the concept color, the abstract entity color, redness, you can't do a science experiment on redness. Existence. You can't do a science experiment on existence. So they wouldn't exist. They're denying their own existence as well. They're denying that their flesh and body or clothes have color. Things like this. So what they're saying is that I'm a materialist. I'm a naturalist. The only thing I believe and the only thing that is real are things that I can know through the five senses, like we talked about last week, empirical findings. But in reality, that's definitely not true. The laws of logic, they make science work itself. Without logic, which is a non-scientific field or subdiscipline, you can't even have a scientific method. You can't even flow through argument. In fact, you can't have propositions. You can't have words. Words aren't science. So what they're saying, again, it's just denying itself. And anything they speak is not science. They can't even talk if that's the case. They need to just be quiet. So it just goes on and on. So the materialist position, as we will see, and this is just the tip of the iceberg for materialism and how to refute it, it's just a terrible, terrible position, also called scientism, naturalism. And people hold this. I've had people come and talk to me, other engineers at places I've worked, and you know they say exactly what you said. Science is the only way we can have knowledge of reality, and it's just a terrible... worldview. Unfortunately, people hold this, and it's because that we see this transfer of ideas through the Enlightenment time, through empiricism from Thomas Hobbes in England, that have trickled down to us today, and it's pervasive in our culture. Okay, so let's take a quick break, 10 minutes, have some food, fellowship. There's a lot in there, actually, so please be friendly, and we'll come back and do some role-playing in the second half. Okay, so the first half, we covered some ideas. This time is going to be a little bit more practical on the street level, and we're going to do a little bit more learning of tactics that we can use in our conversations with people and take our conversations to another level. And this may or may not change your life, but... if you utilize these resources well, you will have really, really different interactions with non-Christians than you ever have before. And you could use these the rest of your life. The burden of proof, if we go to the next slide here. The burden of proof, how many people have heard this phrase, Jesse? Yep, mm-hmm. Okay, so what is the burden of proof without looking at your notes? Jesse.
Well,
like, yeah, I have to prove that I believe this, or like any other type of statement.
Right. So. Yeah, so let's say Hitler killed 6 million Jews. Okay, well, because I'm making the claim, I need to back it up with evidence. Thank you, Jesse. And that's basically what we're saying here. The burden of proof is the responsibility someone has to defend or give evidence for his or her view. The burden of proof has one cardinal rule. Whoever makes the claim bears the burden. Don't allow yourself to be thrust into a defensive position when the other person is making the claim. So this is taken from Greg Kokel in Tactics. Tactics is a book I have back there. And Tactics is a basic book. It's kind of it's like conversational strategies, skills, tactics you can use. And it's very helpful for Christians. So the burden of proof is this idea that a duty is placed upon a civil or criminal defendant to prove or disprove a disputed fact. So during a legal argument, during a court hearing, you will have both sides chatting back and forth. The government, the DA's office, whoever has the burden of persuasion, they're trying to raise the certainty level of the jury to that this person is guilty. But during that all those arguments, there happens to be localized burdens of proof that the defendant will need to prove, or the prosecution side will need to prove. So localized burdens of proof come up all the time in arguments. It could happen just from in the middle of a paragraph. Then the burden of proof is, like, if you say, no, Jesus was not Hindu, then or the person that says Jesus was a Hindu, he has to show that. And instead of us saying, no, he wasn't, we don't need to show that because he made the claim. Jesse stole the bacon, I need to show that. If Jesse says, no, I didn't steal the bacon because I wasn't at the store that day, I was at my friend's house, we were playing Xbox, then he needs to prove that he was at his friend's house playing Xbox because he made the claim. So there's a localized shift happening there. So what else? The burden of proof. So Greg Kokel, his book Tactics presents great techniques and tools. He uses the Socratic method, asking questions. So this is goes back to Socrates back in ancient Greece. Using questions. Questions get you into the driver's seat in a conversation, and you can control the conversation with questions. Questions are diplomatic in nature. They're non-combative. They are neutral. Your views aren't even relevant or stated with a question. You can be a Nazi, atheist, KKK member, and then saying, Professor, can you show me why you think relativism is a good worldview to hold, or why do you think materialism is something, why you are presenting materialism to us? Where are you getting materialism from? Like, why should I believe it? See, I'm just asking a question. And he may think, oh, well, you must be one of those fundamentalist Christians. Well, it's my job to steer you away from your Christianity by the end of the semester so that you'll be an atheist just like me, and you'll be able to think clearly about ideas and not be so brainwashed and looking at the world through this lens of yours. But all I did was ask the question, why should I be a materialist? Right? He's not getting anything about my position from my question. If he infers that, then I could say, look, professor, all I did was ask you a question. You're the professor. I'm the student. You're here to teach me. I'm here to learn. And I'm not here to teach you why you should be a Christian, because I'm a KKK member, Nazi, you know, atheist, whatever. And so tactics are used to show a person their bad thinking and not belittle them. Tactics give you a game plan and helps you maneuver better in conversations. So the Columbo tactic number one, what do you mean by that? First, let's talk about Columbo. Does anybody know who Columbo is? Okay, let's talk about Columbo. Please help us. Who's Columbo?
Detective played by Peter Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And he always acted like he was kind of dumb and bumbling.
Yeah.
He didn't really know what he was doing, but really it was just a trick.
Right. That's right. And this was how long ago? Okay. So I remember seeing my grandpa's, grandparents' house. They'd be watching this thing all the time. What else do we know about Columbo? Anybody else? He never had a pencil. What's that?
Fake eye.
Fake eye, okay. So Columbo was this character who played Peter Crawl? Falk, that's right, Peter Falk. And it was a long time ago, and this show was on the air all the time, and it was super boring to watch as a kid, but it's kind of interesting because he would leave a crime scene or come back to a crime scene later on. He was a crime scene detective, and this is before CSI was so cool. So you had this guy, he had this weird funky trench coat, and he'd walk into these situations, and he'd be talking to the people that were supposedly related to the crime and what happened, and he's like, you know, something seems fishy to me. And then he fumbles around looking for a pencil, and people just think, like, who's this goofball? And they write him off. And he's, you know, kind of putting on this act, but as he's walking out the door, he's like, you know, wait a minute, I got a question. And he says, what about this? And he starts with one question, and then another question, and another question. And it turns out that he's got that person, you know, the wife of the slain husband or whatever, she's, you know, up against the wall backtracking because she just kind of wasn't careful. She got cut off guard because he was being so goofy. And the idea here is that we don't want to be exactly like Columbo with his goofiness, but the Columbo actor, we want to use as a reminder, and it's maybe a good visual for us to remember Columbo in our conversations. Remember Columbo when we talk to people, and remember these tactics, because it's hard in the conversation to get back on the right track or get our feet on the ground when maybe we feel confident maybe here, but then we reach the conversation there and it's hard to kind of remember how to start or where to go. So think of Columbo, think of his weird questions, and you don't have to know it all. You don't even have to know apologetics. Or any material at all, if you can just remember Columbo, that one word, and it will help you trigger these tactics that we're about to learn. Tactic number one, what do you mean by that? This is gathering information. Gather information about the person's view in a friendly and cordial manner without having to defend your view at all. So here are some examples. All religions are basically the same. What do you say? What do you mean by that? How are they the same? You can follow it up with another question. But the first question, what do you mean by that? You hear that a lot. All religions are basically the same. Another example, you shouldn't force your views on me. What do you mean by that? Are you forcing your view on me? So again, you started with a question, another question, and just ask. Like, you could keep it cordial. This is with maybe your boss lurking around in the office. You know, you don't want to get all crazy. But you just respond, oh, what do you mean by that? How are all the religions the same? And could you tell me about Christianity and Judaism? Do you know what the differences are between the two? I mean, Jews say Jesus was not the Messiah. Christians say he was. Is that a difference to you? If it is, then all religions are not the same, are they? So there's just an example. You could play that out in your head, but you don't need to play it out exactly for them like that. You may want to be a little bit more diplomatic. Here's another example. Everyone interprets the Bible differently and everyone's view is valid. Okay, well, what do you mean by that? See, I'm just flowing along the conversation. I'm not trying to refute their position, am I? I'm just asking more questions. I'm gathering more information. Tell me about your view without saying these nice sayings that you hear all these other people say. Spell it out for me. Make it really clear and tell me in a bunch of different ways so I could pick it apart more easily. You're not telling them that, but that's what you're doing. You're trying to hear what they're saying differently than the facade and the masquerade of culture or postmodernism. You're trying to get behind that. Here's another example. There's no way that God can exist when there's so much evil in the world. So you hear people say this all the time, like the tsunami in Indonesia a few years ago, the earthquake in Haiti. Well, what do you mean by evil? What do you mean by that? Spell this idea out for me. Tell me a little bit more about your proposition. One more. You're intolerant. Okay. What do you mean by that? Do you mean I'm guilty of, you know, stealing your radio and beating up your child because they're not Christian? What are you trying to say? Are you just saying that I'm finding other people's lifestyle unacceptable? Spell that out for me. How intolerant am I being? Am I really physically imposing my view on you? What are you trying to say? Tell me more. What do you mean by that? So we hear you're intolerant a lot. And so this is just a way to gather more information so you can pick it apart a little easily later. You had a question?
What you're actually doing is you're putting them on the defense, but it's only, it's a trap that they devise themselves, so they can't be angry at you.
Correct.
They can't be angry themselves for getting trapped.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, all we're trying to do with a lot of this is expose faulty thinking. And some people will say, well, you know what I mean. You know, well, no, I don't. What do you mean? Because they just are so used to espousing these cultural isms, and they get you so used to it, and they're comfortable with it. And yeah, we want to show them, not even through our argument that we're presenting, but we're just showing them through a question where their own flaws are so they can correct it. Yeah. Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. They haven't thought it through. It's just something they picked up somewhere, and then they live their life by it, and it doesn't make sense when you actually hash it out. Yeah. Absolutely. We get attacked so many times as Christians. We get stonewalled, and we have this stonewalled look on our face. But in reality, we don't have to even retreat one bit. We stand there and just say, clarify your position. You have the burden of proof because you made the statement. Tell me more about your view before I start responding to it. Because that's where we get in trouble, right? Yeah. Yeah, what was the first thing you said? Yeah.
And I find a lot of them, they're not really looking for answers.
Yeah.
They're looking, of course, Christians will give them answers, and of course, these are ones that they always can shoot down.
Yeah.
So I think these are great questions to find out, you know,
more about. Where are you coming up with this? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
One of the reasons why you do that is because those very people are typically like Muslims, relatives, and then the same people that will say there's no objective good. So you get to the place where you tell them that if there's no objective good, there wouldn't be evil either.
Right. So what she's offering is this idea that, like you said, when they say the word evil, we can actually ask them, where are you coming up with your definition and concept of evil from? Where do you get evil? Where do you get your concept of good from? Because a lot of times, they, like you were saying, people just spout out these ideas. But if you really think about how do they trace, where do they trace the origination of good and evil from? Apart from God, which we'll learn later, you can't trace the origination of evil. There's no starting point for it. You have to have an all-good God for us to have any conception of goodness and evilness, evil being the absence of good or the tweaking of the good. And yeah, so what they're uttering is objective evil exists, and in order to have objective evil, you have to have objective good. And in order to have, if you have both, then you have to have a source from these things. And C.S. Lewis was the one who espoused this argument that basically, if you're an atheist, non-Christian, or relativist, postmodernist, if you think that evil exists, then you're actually proving God's existence through that line of reasoning. And we'll go through that a lot more slowly, week 17 or something. So we won't get caught up on that right now. But questions do provide us this opportunity because we ask them to spell out exactly what they're saying. Yeah?
Just a quick statement. But I also notice, too, when people usually attack like that, it's usually, I notice like a lot of Christians, they take it like really personal. Like I take it personal, too, sometimes, and I feel like really try not to because it really has nothing to do with you. Like, it actually has something to do with God. It's them and God.
Yeah.
But we automatically attack and try to like defend ourselves and take it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we get real flustered with these comments, and we should. Something inside of us should stir up, like, no, stop bashing Christianity. God exists. Leave me alone, you know, or go figure it out. I can get really, really pissed off when people make these statements. But what I need to tell myself is don't respond, ask a question. Columbo, think Columbo. This is so nice because it engages them, it flatters them, it forces them to think more carefully about and precisely about what they mean, like we said. It helps you know what their position is, and you can listen to the information more, and you can even formulate a response when that time comes around later as they keep talking. You're still in control of the conversation if you're using good questions. You are in control because they're being interviewed, aren't they? Their views are being unfolded, and you know exactly, you can start seeing exactly the flaws, and we're going to learn a little bit more how to do that. So you can use this question all day long. What do you mean by that? Columbo tactic number two, how did you get to that conclusion? So say they spell out their view for you and say it in a bunch of different ways. Our next question is, okay, well, now I know your thesis really well. Show me your line of reasoning. Show me your argumentation. Show me your evidence. How did you get to that conclusion? What reasons did you use to get to that conclusion? Why did you say that? Why do you say that, we could ask. What are your reasons for holding that view? Why should I believe what you believe? What makes you think that that's the right way to see it? I'm curious. Why would you say a thing like that? And these are just questions to get them to tell us their reasons for their view. How did you get to the conclusion that I should trust that your organization, the Mormon Church, Joseph Smith, or the Watchtower, if you're a Jehovah's Witness, speaks for God? How do you know? How did you get to the conclusion that these people, these organizations, speak for God? Because that's what they believe. Why do you believe that? So this tactic, again, puts the burden of proof on them. It reverses the burden of proof to encourage the other person to give reasons for their views. So Jesus went to India. How did you... They say Jesus went to India and reincarnation came from the Bible. Well, how did you get to that conclusion? You never know anything for sure. How did you get to that conclusion? Morals are just invented by culture. How did you get to that conclusion? I'm curious. Christians wrote the Bible, so it's bias. How did you get to that conclusion? See, these are assertions, aren't they? These are statements. They're not arguments. We don't need to provide a rebuttal to an argument that doesn't exist. They're making an assertion. Let's have them spell out their line of reasoning. And this is nice. We're being nice. We're being diplomatic. They will like it. Because we're not just sitting there starting to lecture. And again, we haven't even learned all this stuff about apologetics. We're still kind of in the introductory foundational material here. And later on, we're going to do a little role play here and practice these questions. We don't know how to respond to these. We don't know how to present a case for our thesis, but we will. But right now, all we need to do is use our questions. let's see. Let's skip down a little bit. This is kind of more of the same thing. If the argument is going to die, let it die. If people are like, "Well, this is just what I think," and they start walking away, well, don't hold them there and let them go. You know, be a normal person. We don't have to bring up Jesus in every single conversation. We don't have to talk about the Trinity and, you know, there's 12 apostles, just like there was the 12 tribes of Israel, see? So we don't have to do that. We just be normal people, and if anything, if you don't do anything else, you can just put a pebble in their shoe, asking them to clarify their view. That's my 8:30 buzzer. If anybody needs to get going, please feel free to do so right now. That's fine. We're going to go to 8:45, and no harm, no foul if you have to take off. We just want to make sure that people who take the time to get here get something out of it. The burden of proof lies on the one making the claim. Again, if you're in a class and there's a professor, you know, putting forth his view on whatever, you don't have to get in a head-to-head collision with him. He's got the mic. He's this guy in authority. You don't want to take him on in a full frontal attack. You want to use questions like we kind of talked about in the first half. Columbo tactic number 3, leading the way. And by the way, if someone is bombarding you with questions like, oh, what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? And they're just bombarding you with a bunch of statements and they're all over the place and they're just not letting you talk, that's fine. Just let them do that and be nice and say, okay, that's great. I'm glad you told me your view. And these are called steamrollers and you don't want to get in their way. Just let them do their thing and get out of there because you're going to get rolled over. And you can say, let me think about what you said. I'll get back to you. And that's totally fine. If you guys ask me questions, I don't know. I'm going to tell you. I don't know. Let me think about it. I'll get back to you. And you should do the same thing. Okay? Let's see. Columbo tactic number 3, leading the way. This takes us on offense now. Okay. Use these questions to expose a weakness or a flaw. So this is finding a fallacy, a misstep, a non sequitur, etc. Use these questions to take the conversations where you want it to go. So that this tactic takes insight and listening to the answers in number 1 and number 2. So if you lack knowledge or if they aren't interested in the conversation, let it die a natural death. So these are more questions that you can use once you start to see why they believe what they believe and what they really believe behind their fancy statements. Use these questions to now start going on the offense and help expose the flaws. Can you consider, blah, blah, blah. Have you considered, blah, blah, blah. Can you clear this up for me? It sounds like what you're saying is that you think killing babies is okay as long as they're in the mother's womb. Is that what you're really saying? You know, just pose it as a question. You know, put it back to them in a way that they will hear it differently than how they've always thought it. Can you help me understand this? You can even use a transitional statement. Let me suggest an alternative and tell me if you think it's an improvement. You could cross out the letter E there. Here's what I think would be a more accurate representation. And this is totally fine. If they've given you their view and they spelled it out fully, this is maybe something you can do to now take the conversation back or take the conversation in a different direction. I wouldn't characterize it that way. Here's what I think would be a more accurate representation. Okay? So people do this actually a lot, and they just say wrong things, or they talk about, say, George Bush a certain way. George W. Bush is a terrorist. You know, he's a whatever, and they just, I'm not, you know, speaking up for W, but I'm just giving that as an example that he gets attacked a lot, and people mischaracterize him, just like Christians mischaracterize Obama all the time. So we need to be aware of that. Well, I wouldn't represent it that way. Here's maybe a different way to put it. Let's see. Some may ask us leading questions, or label us ignorant or intolerant or fundamentalist. We can sidestep these questions and offer our own. Well, it's funny that you are making me sound like an intolerant bigot when you say that I think Jesus is the only way and everybody that doesn't agree with me is going to go to hell. I appreciate you making me look like that, but I want to get back to what your position is, because that's the position that I find extremely irrational and totally illogical, and I don't want to paint you foolishly, but I want you to spell out your position with some reasons instead of attacking me as a person. Let's see. Okay, let's go to Perfecting Columbo. That's item D there. Defending against Columbo. We have a few more minutes and we're going to do a role play and then we'll be done. Perfecting against Columbo. If someone is using number one and two on us, if someone's asking us questions one and two, we can answer them. Hey, why do you, what do you mean by that if they ask us? How do you get to that conclusion? We can use, if we hear these being used on us, we can respond and tell people about our view. This is a great opportunity for us. And they think they're in the control of the conversation. That's totally fine. But you know what? Maybe the gospel will be preached in that in some way. You could squeeze it in there maybe, depending on the context. Let's see. Don't follow the bait if it's a trap. If someone is proceeds with a leading question number three, can you consider blah blah blah? If they use that to us, can you consider that the one cell amoeba was really part of our ancestry and we really did come from monkeys? Can you even consider that, Mr. Christian? Yeah, well, I can actually. But let me get back to the idea that you're presenting. Can you give me evidence for that, you know, flow? You know, we can use our questions to put it back on them. That's the whole idea. Put it back on them. Let them spell out their view. We don't have to know everything about apologetics or be the best people to share the gospel. We can all do this. Anybody can do this. Child can do this. Use questions. Okay, when they come at us and use loaded questions, this is when it gets confusing, when you get a loaded question. What gives you the right to say that homosexuality is wrong? Or who are you to say that my interpretation of Jesus is wrong? Who's to say that, whatever? You know, they use these questions. What gives you the right? Who are you to say? Who's to say? Don't follow the bait. It's a trap. Don't get stuck with this. What gives you the right? That question really means no one is justified saying X. No one is really justified saying that homosexuality is wrong. No one is justified saying that Jesus was the Son of God. That's what they're really saying, is what gives you the right to say that Jesus is the Son of God and he's the only way? That's what they're really saying. We need to see through this. Who are you to say really means one answer is just as good as another. That's what they really mean. Or they mean no one can ever know the truth about X. No one can ever know the truth about Jesus. We can't know the truth about the Old Testament. We can't know the truth about the existence of God. That's what they are saying with that question. Who's to say really means you are wrong for saying someone else is wrong. But this is a self-contradictory statement. That's what that means. You are wrong for what who's to say means. You are wrong for saying someone else is wrong. So we come back to this self-contradictory statement that Kristen brought up. Before, every statement is about something. If you think about statements, they're always referring to something. When we utter things, we're always talking about something. This word about, think of the word about or this relationship between what we're saying, a direct object and a subject. That's the majority, pretty much all of our statements. Sometimes our statements can be about themselves. Like I can make a statement about the statement that I'm making, like I just did. Suicidal statements, though, fail to satisfy their own criteria or their own standards, so they can't take their own advice. That's a suicidal statement. If it's suicidal, it's self-defeating. I'll give you some quick examples of suicidal statements. There is no truth. Well, that obviously is an objective truth, isn't it? There is no truth. You're telling me that you know objectively, you know this objective truth that there are no truths. Obviously, that's self-contradictory. You can't know the truth. Oh, really? How do you know? No one has the truth. Do you have the truth about no one has the truth? No. So that statement is self-defeating. All truth is relative. Really? Even that statement that you made, that truth statement you made, all truth is relative, is that relative too? If so, why should I agree with you? Why should I listen to you? Prove it to me. You can't, because that statement defeats itself. Similar thing here. It's true for you, but not for me. We hear this a lot. This statement is self-refuting. It claims that truth is relative to the individual, and yet at the same time it implies that it is objectively true, that something can be true for you but not true for me. So we could respond saying that, is that true for you or is it true for everybody? See, we have to expose faulty thinking. It's true for you but not for me, it doesn't make sense. It's self-contradictory. There's the same thing with this statement. There are no absolutes. This statement is an absolute statement about reality that claims that there are no absolutes, right? There are no absolutes. Well, you're telling me something that is an absolute, aren't you? No one can know the truth about religion. Well, how do you know that truth about religion? You can't. You don't know. That isn't a truth about religion. You can't even utter that. You can't know anything for sure, similar to what we said before. You should doubt everything. Okay, then I'm doubting what you're saying. Only science can give us truth. We talked about that already. You shouldn't judge. Okay, then why are you judging me? You shouldn't force your morality on other people. Then why are you forcing your morality on me? Okay, these things we hear all the time. These are self-defeating statements. You should live and let live. Okay. Yeah. Oh, you know what? I'm going off of my own.
Oh, okay.
28 was blank, and it should have been cut off, so it's 27 to 27. Sorry, but I'm going off of this stuff. Let's see. You shouldn't try to convert people. Then why are you trying to convert me? You should be tolerant of all views. Then why are you being intolerant of my view? It is arrogant to claim that you have the only truth. Well, that is exactly what you're doing. You're claiming that you have the only truth about people, that people should only say that they have relative truth. That's pretty arrogant of that person. Okay. So there's examples of these. Some of them are more clear than others. And again, a lot of this stuff I'm not like making up on my own. It's stuff that I just gathered from all these different places. They're on the internet, these self-defeating statements, if you want to look them up in detail and see exactly how they're self-defeating and explained a little bit more clearly. Take your time, do that. And then we're going to end. We have 2 minutes left, which is just enough time as we need. And what we want to do is we want to ask each other some crazy things or make crazy statements to each other and just respond with tactics. Just respond with questions. You don't even have to know how to use, you don't even have to know any apologetics. Just respond with these questions. And then if the other person can, just play the atheist or agnostic or non-Christian a little while longer. And you know, obviously people, atheists aren't all mean or something like that. Just be a normal person and try to kind of go along with that argument and make it sound like you're really, you know, wondering or attacking or whatever. And then we'll switch and have the other person do that role too. Okay? So the questions are, if you could put them up here, just form little love groups, little connection groups, and be friendly. One-on-one is great. Three is fine too. So can you put the next slide up? Okay, the questions that I want you to ask yourself, if you keep going all through this. Someone was asleep at the wheel, apparently. it's okay. Okay, so I want you to ask these, and there's one more, these three questions to each other, or make these statements. Look, they're not even questions. Just make these statements to each other, and if you're the person that's playing the role of Christian, then just use a question. Okay, and then the other person can kind of play along a little bit more, and then we'll switch, okay? So the first person ask the first two, and then the second person will ask the third one, okay? So the people on closest to this wall ask the first two, and then the people closest to this wall be the Christian, okay? Ready, go. Yeah, he's going to be the... Yeah. Use your questions. What do you mean by that? How did you get to that conclusion? Okay, if you can switch, so the other person on near this wall play the role of non-Christian, and the person near this wall play the role of Christian. That's the last question. Remember, what do you mean by that? How did you get to that conclusion? That's all you got to say. Okay, let's bring it back here. Let's bring it back so we can close. Let's kind of hash this out real quick. We got a minute left. Who here felt like they have now a question or a tool, maybe a small tool, but a tool just to use? Do you kind of feel like you have at least a tool in your toolbox? Okay, a few of us. Yeah. Who here thought it was helpful to have these tools? Okay, good. And did anybody play the role of non-Christian or atheist a lot and have some other good things to add? No, everyone was being really nice. Okay. Okay, well, thank you for doing that. I hope that it's just a practice so you can just start to understand what it's like to take this on the street and use it. And just like, oh yeah, I know how to do the tactics, Columbo things, so you'll kind of get more comfortable. A lot of evangelism, pre-evangelism, whatever, it's all about practice. It really is. I mean, unless you start doing it, unless you start role-playing, you're really going to be scared, you're going to be tongue-tied when it happens, and this is just a way for us to kind of learn how to talk to people about Christianity. Any questions before we close? Yeah.
I just want to comment on that third one. It's actually saying two things. The first part, what Christians believe is like their statement. The second part is they're idiots.
Yeah. It's loaded, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's an attack on us, and that's what we get a lot. We get loaded statements, loaded questions, and that's why the first question is so great. What do you mean by that? Spell it all out for me, because you're saying a whole lot with that little phrase you just uttered. Yeah, and it gets us all flustered, so we don't need to be. We can just use our tactics. Yeah?
Just real quick, just a second. Which philosopher did that? And of course, like, who's...
Yeah, great question.
They wouldn't even know who to go to.
Yeah, great question. How did you get to that conclusion is what you were asking. How did you get to that conclusion? Where's your evidence? Where's your data? Where's your history? Where's your reasons? Yeah. Okay, let's close in a word of prayer. Father God, we thank you so much for this time to be together, and we're thrilled that we get to learn how to represent you correctly and appropriately, and we pray that you would help us love people where they're at and help them feel special and just accepted, even though, Lord, we want them to eventually come to know you. God, we want to expose their faulty thinking so they can have their walls torn down, God, and we thank you that you've given us these valuable resources and folks like Greg Kokel and others who give them to us through your grace and your wisdom. We pray that you will bless us this week and this weekend and keep us all safe. In Jesus' name, amen.